So my talk today is discussing risk communication in the 21st century. It's going to be a broad presentation to give you a bit of a taste on the area of risk perception and communication. I should clarify to you, I'm a risk communication guy. I've been active in this area since the 1986 Chernobyl accident. So it has been a while. As you see, I'm losing my hair as a result. There you go. So disclosure slide, I have no idea what to say here, so I decided to mention everybody. So over the past year, my students and I have received research grants, meeting sponsorships from Biogenetic, BP, Bromine Science and Environment Forum, CEFIX Long Range Research Initiative, the Royal Netherlands Academy of Arts and Sciences, as well as the Irish Medicines Board, the Swedish Radiation Agency, UK Department of Work and Pensions, UK Royal Society of Chemistry, and the Dutch Ministry of the Infrastructure and Environment, not Interior. Just being transparent to you all. So in this talk today, I'm going to provide a definition of risk perception and communication and put it into context with some examples. B, discuss why risk communication is important for the public health professionals, and finally, offer some possible solutions going forward. And I really hope you think this is interesting because I flew all the way from London to present this for you here this morning.
I forgot to say that. Yes.
It's okay. Don't worry about it. So risk perception, first point, in the importance of heuristics and biases. Heuristics and biases are so-called mental shortcuts. And I think this one book you should read is by Daniel Kahneman, Thinking Fast and Slow. Has anybody read it? There you go. Isn't it just brilliant or what? That's absolutely great. We love Kahneman's book. And he discusses a series of factors there. He mentions, for example, the so-called anchoring effect. The anchoring effect occurs when people consider a particular value for an unknown quantity before estimating that quantity. So, if you're asked whether Gandhi was more than 114 years old when he died, you will end up with a much higher number if you ask whether he's more than 35. When he says 114, he said, well, he must have been dead when he was 90. When they give numbers 35, he was older than 35 when he died. Maybe he was 50. Another important variable is a so-called simplifying heuristic. And from Kahneman's book, I quote, an individual has been described by a neighbor as follows. Steve is very shy and withdrawn, invariably helpful, but with little interest in people or in the world of reality. A meek and tidy soul, he has a need for order and structure and a passion for detail. Is Steve more likely to be a librarian or a farmer? And he's from the United States. What do you guys think? Hands up for a librarian. The guy's a meek and tidy soul is a wimp, okay? Of course he's a librarian. Any farmers? You know, there you go. The answer is basically, he's a farmer. There are 20 times more male farmers than librarians in the United States. Therefore, by following stats, this meek and tidy soul is a wimpy farmer. There you go. Another important issue is availability heuristic. We're all affected by the media, available information. As a result, people think there are more homicides and suicides in the United States. And as you all know in this room, it's exactly the opposite. Understanding base rates, big samples are better than small samples is something the media does often get wrong. And hindsight bias, noodle along effect, basically saying, you know, well, we knew the Japanese were going to bomb Pearl Harbor in 1941 because Roosevelt went against the war. And as you all know, that's completely nonsense. The work of Kahneman and Tversky and others influenced the work of Brooke Fischoff, Paul Slovic, and Sarah Lichtenstein. And they looked at a number of different factors how people perceive risks. One important element was so-called natural vis-a-vis technological. Natural hazards are seen to be an act of God. There is no one to blame. Technological hazards are seen to be acts of humans. There are some to blame. Sometimes with regard to natural hazards, people actually go out and seek natural hazards. When I was doing my PhD at Clark University in Worcester, Massachusetts, once in a while, my undergraduate students came by, and I was a TA for them. So, you know, Ragnar, we're going to cut class tomorrow. I said, why? We're going down to Florida, to the Keys, mate. I said, why are you doing that for? Oh, we're going to go there and get a flat and get an apartment and buy a few bottles of rum, and we're going to party the hurricane, they said. And they came back and discussed these incredible hurricane parties. We were completely blind drunk at how fun it was. What do you think happened with regard to the Three Mile Island accident in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, in 1979, when the radio person said, we've had a minor incident in TMI, and we suggest that all women who are pregnant to evacuate within a radius of 20 miles. What do you think happened? Everybody evacuated, which meant that no one did, but their roads were clogged. Do you think anybody said, wow, what an opportunity, let's go and party TMI? No, they didn't. Another important variable is the whole issue of voluntary versus vis-a-vis involuntary. People are 1,000 times more worried about involuntary risks than voluntary ones. People actually go to seek risks, skiing, for example, because people like the thrill of speed, like the risk and danger. But we don't really worry about skiing, are we? No, we're not. And a third example, the wish of familiar vis-a-vis unfamiliar. We are terrified of the unknown, but some risks we accept. Now, can I give you a little personal example here? Is this something that bugged my family? The whole issue of bird flu. So I spent my weeks traveling everywhere in Europe and in North America, and during the infamous Scottish swan incident, when a swan was found off the coast of Scotland, I was in Brussels that evening. I'm married, I have two daughters, and I live by the tennis courts in Wimbledon. Came back home, it was late, and my wife said, the oldest daughter is crying upstairs, see what's going on. And I ran upstairs, it's a good father, and she was bawling her eyes out. I said, sweetheart, why are you crying for? And she says, Papa, I'm worried about dying, she says. She was 12 back then, or something like that. And I said, oh, bloody hell, it's getting earlier and earlier and earlier. It's ridiculous. And I said, sweetheart, but why are you gonna die for him? What's going on? I'm worried about dying from bird flu, she says. Bird flu? A 12-year-old in London, bird flu? But sweetheart, why from bird flu? But Papa, look, I have a bird turd on my window, she says. And I look at her and I smile and I pick on some Southeast Asian country. Don't get offended, please. And I said, sweetheart, you will not die of bird flu here in SW19 part of London here tonight. If, however, you slept with, 5,000 ducks, you were based in Vietnam, maybe after 9 months you might get bird flu, but not here in London. And she looked at me like all kids do and said, Papa, are you sure? And I smiled back at her and said, sweetheart, I am positive. I'm professor of risk management, and you say goodnight now. And that was it. And she said goodnight, and I said goodnight, and I said, thank goodness I solved that one. One mission accomplished today. I went downstairs and said, what the hell is going on? Why is my daughter freaked out about bird flu? So it turned out, and I'm going to be very polite here, not to mention any names, turned out that a very senior communication person in the UK government had said on television, it's not a question of if, but when, we'll have 50,000 people dead from bird flu in the UK. I said, this is completely nuts. So what I did then the next morning is I made a few phone calls. I went to call the local general practitioner surgeries around my area of London, and I asked them, has anybody called to you about bird flu? And so, oh, it's been horrible, they said. It's an absolute disaster. So what's going on? Oh, these old age pensioners, because they have time on their hands, they'll be calling you, and they're saying basically, A, can I have a vaccination against bird flu? B, can I have some kind of antiviral, Tamiflu or something like that? And C, they said, I have bird flu. There you go. So at this stage, I use all my various titles and I block myself in and I demand to speak to the head of communications for the UK government in the Cabinet Office, Sir Howard, his name is. I say, I want to see you now. And for some bizarre reason, Sir Howard decides to see me. Now, coming there, he has his various bird flu experts, so they're all very cross and body language is absolutely horrible. They're crossing their arms, they stare, almost sneering at me. And they said basically, so what's the problem, Professor? I said, are you completely crazy? Why are you communicating 50,000 people be dead of bird flu? You, my friend, have no evidence of that. What you're doing is you're taking basically an estimation from WHO, which said maybe zero people die of bird flu, maybe 750,000 people. And you say, oop, 50,000. You know what? That is really stupid, I said. What you should have said is, be honest. The publics of the UK are not stupid. Be honest to them. Say, we don't know how many people died of bird flu. It might be zero. It might be 750,000 individuals. And what we're going to do now, we're going to set up an expert panel of bird flu experts, and we'll be meeting once a week until we know. That's the truth, and the public basically deserve honesty. Something that Rear Admiral mentioned this morning as well. Honesty is absolutely crucial. And by the way, I said, don't ever have that fruitcake person speaking in television again, because that number is completely wrong. So then I walked out because I was really cross with them. And it turned out basically the fruitcake was never on television again, and the number was quickly taken out. What was the risk, basically, of dying of bird flu? How many folks died of bird flu in the UK? Zero. Not one person. Killed a few turkeys in East Anglia, but no people died. Is this talk interesting, by the way? That was worth coming from London, thank goodness. So I have basically 7 more minutes or something like that?
About.
So basically another important factor is the issue of control vis-a-vis non-control. We want to be in control at all times. And that's therefore basically when you're with your loved one, you are the one who wants to drive the car because you trust yourself more than you trust your loved one. And when you don't drive that car, you become a backseat driver. Think about it, you have a lot of quarrels in cars as a result. Another important factor is the high frequency, low consequence risk vis-a-vis low frequency, high consequence risk. We worry much more about risks that have low frequency, high consequence, as in the so-called kill sizes. Therefore, we worry more basically about flying than about driving, although many more people die per year by driving. But basically what happens to the numbers are much smaller. It's 1, 2, 3 people. While on an airplane, you have several hundred. So if you die in a car accident, I can guarantee you won't make the local news tonight, but if you die in an airplane accident, you will. And finally, female vis-a-vis male. Research here shows from Jen Lerner that both women and men are, of course, emotional. But when men get emotional, they get angry. Angry, associated with risk-taking. With women, basically, they become fearful. So based on these findings, regulators and industry took the view that one should develop risk communication programs to build nuclear power plants, site nuclear waste facilities, and the like. And basically, they used 3 types of strategies forward. So-called top-down, communicating down to you, like here. Dialogue, sitting with you in the audience, and bottom up, starting basically at a local level, and then escalating to a national level, and escalating to an international level. As you can gather, risk communication is still very difficult to do. There are a number of variables for that. One is the issue of social amplification or the social attenuation. Some risks are socially amplified, a la Ebola. Some risks are not. Some risks are attenuated. So-called taboo risks. Sexually transmitted diseases are attenuated. The whole issue of depression is attenuated, as well as suicides are attenuated. Other issues are important, the so-called narrative effect. People like stories. One thing you remember from my talk today, I think, is my bird flu example, because it's a personal story. What I tell them people to do, though, is if you're going to use stories, make sure you compare apples with apples and not apples with oranges to ensure, basically, that living next to a nuclear power station is as dangerous as smoking one cigarette in a lifetime is a bad example. Because smoking a cigarette is a what? Is a basically a voluntary risk. And being forced to live next to a nuclear power station is an involuntary one. Deliberation can be very important. But the problem with deliberation, my friends, is a so-called self-selection bias. Many of us don't have time or interest or want to participate in when you have a big discussion with regard to, for example, siting a waste incinerator. I was involved with one study in the North Black Forest in Germany on this. We asked 3,500 people to participate in the study. How many participated? 200 participated, and they had 3 things in common. A, they were opposed to incinerator to begin with. B, basically, they had time on their hands. They were basically students, they were unemployed, or they were retirees. And politically, they were more left of center than right of center. So that of course, created a certain bias. The whole issue of importance of optimistic bias is absolutely crucial here. Is that we've all been programmed to be optimistic. So, for example, if you smoke, you don't think you'll die of lung cancer or get stroke, but the person down the road here will basically die of lung cancer or stroke. Similarly, if you drink a bottle of whiskey a day, you think, I have this perfect Ragnar liver, my liver will last forever. But that person down here in the French district, that person drinking the bottle of whiskey a day, it will definitely get something wrong with his liver. I'm absolutely positive of that. And finally, trust. As we know, trust studies show if you have high levels of public trust in regulators, you have low levels of public perceived risk, and vice versa. I'm going to skip this slide. So why is this all important for public health professionals? Public health issues are often amplified by the media. We see it happening right now with regard to Ebola. There's a strong public health children link, obviously. There's a scale effect. Many individuals are exposed to similar public health issues at the same time. And many of the risk factors are relevant to the public health area, such as unfamiliarity that I mentioned earlier. So what can we do about it going forward? I have 2 more slides and I'll finish. A, we should promote media communication guidelines, like BBC and or Harvard IFIC. The issue here is I think the media need to become better communicators of risk science and uncertainty than what they are today. This is especially the case, I know, from the UK, assuming the same problems here in the US. We should find neutral, charismatic, trusted third parties to speak on the sector's behalf. Individuals or Nobel Prize winners, for example, and others who have command their respect from the public. We should help regulators and policymakers become better communicators. Many regulators and policymakers are not good communicators, are terrified communicating, and that we who are active in the risk communication, health communication area, We need to help them to become better communicators. We should also ensure that scientists themselves become more honest communicators. The crucial question here in many universities, at least around the UK, is you have people being put forward loaded press releases to get media attention, which is actually far too loaded and not basically based on what the science actually says in the paper they've just published. We should promote the establishment of a genuine European Academy of Sciences. Here is something I must say we in Europe are very jealous of, that you have a National Academy of Sciences here in the US. We'd love to have one exported back to Europe, please. We should help public health regulators in Europe, such bodies would include a European Medical Agency and a UK MHRA, establish independent risk communication advisory boards, such as the one that FDA has in place, which was led by many years by Professor Brooke Fischoff at Carnegie Mellon. It's absolutely crucial to have more RISCOM advisory boards rather than less. We should help ensure that public health bodies pre-test their communications messages. I find this completely actually obvious, but when I go and speak to regulators, you know, in the UK, or meet, you know, various individuals in the Netherlands, I was in The Hague last week and elsewhere, you know, they tell me they don't pre-test their messages. I find this is absolutely extraordinary. When I have my students doing studies, I make sure they pre-test their messages. This is like a basically bottom line. I mean, public health bodies need to pre-test the messages to ensure the communication becomes right. So you don't necessarily worry the public sort of patients in the community. This is something that needs to be done with utmost urgency. We should support the establishment of a formal working group on risk in the European Parliament, as well as in U.S. Congress, to ensure that we have the best evidence-based policymaking available going forward. And finally, we should ensure that the communication director within a public health bodies is part of the executive function. In many cases today, they are not. They'd be below the executive function, and I think that's frankly wrong. They should be in the front table helping to make important decisions on communication for the community as a whole. On that note, I say thank you very much for your attention.
What we will do is ask one or two burning questions, and then we'll go to the next session.
Otherwise, I'll be outside at 10 o'clock if you want to flag me down then.
Yeah. So one or two burning questions, and then we'll go on to the other.
We have one question in the back there.
One question in the back, yes.
What do you pre-test when you pre-test? So, for example, the European Medical Agency is doing quite a bit of work trying to promote evidence-based policymaking and medicine issues. So one issue there, for example, would be, is that, you know, should we withdraw a certain medicine? And they put forward a quote and put it in a press release. That quote has not been pre-tested. They developed basically a couple of paragraphs, and they said, this is it, we have a press release in place, we'll put it out there. I asked the head of communications at EMA, have you checked that this quote will actually get the desired results that you want to have, that people are aware of what's going on and this medicine being withdrawn? They said, no, we had sat down before a morning session and brainstormed it. I asked them, so who was involved? Me as head of communications, and we had two medical doctors. Well, nobody else in the room? No. Did you ask anybody else outside the room? No. Frankly, that's not good enough. We need to take those two paragraphs, we need to test them in a wider group, preferably with people outside the EMA, actually real patients and publics. And if that's not possible, we're basically in more greater amount, number of individuals within EMA, and that wasn't done. This stuff needs to be done much more going forward.
Thank you so much.